The following audio is from the weekly message at Summit Church in the upstate of South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
I hope you realize what a gift our worship team and Chris and Jesse and the others who serve in the back are. And when you see them, take time to thank them for the way they think about leading us. That is a real gift and one I hope we never take for granted. If you have your Bibles, you can open them to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We're just going to kind of kick off an intro, a little bit of our time in this book, and we'll jump right into the first 11 verses or so here in just a moment, just to capture what it is that's being talked about. And I think you'll see early on that this book sounds and feels different than most, and it probably going to hit us a little differently than most, because the perspective of the book is unique, and the way in which the book is framed is intentional, I think, to kind of create a tension that Chris had just acknowledged and create a little bit of a wrestle. If anything, I would say it's potentially a book that was intended to force us to be reflective, to possibly expose our hearts and minds and motives in the midst of everything going on in life. I think if we were honest, we would say that the last few years, not that other years don't do this, but the last couple in particular perhaps, have reminded us of a couple of things. One is that we know what it's like, and everybody around you knows what it's like, to be tired. And I'm not just talking physically, although that's true for many, but you know what it's like to be weary and worn down and to feel the weight of life. People know what that's like. You don't have to try hard for that. You could look around this room. I would imagine that you wouldn't have to go more than a person or two to your right or left or front and behind you to find somebody who goes, yeah, the last couple of years have been heavy. They've had sweet moments. They've had really beautiful things happen within them. They've had even lessons I wouldn't have learned otherwise, or practices that I've started that are now life-giving as the result. But I can look back and I can go, actually, I know again, or I know afresh, that life in a fallen and broken world because of the effects of sin on this world is heavy, wearisome. And you would also find perhaps the second reality that I think we've been forced to face in some way, shape, or form, and we're always forced to face it at some point or another, and that is that in this world corrupted by sin, death is a reality for all of us. We may go along at times kind of forgetting about it, ignoring it, pretending as though it doesn't exist, or even attempting in some way, shape, or form to outrun it or to cheat it. But at God's providential hand, there comes time in life where we all face it in some way, shape, or form. The loss of someone we love, or our own mortality right in front of us. And I think Ecclesiastes does a really powerful job of saying, if those things exist as true in the midst of all that happens under the sun in this world, then what's the point? Where's the meaning? Where is the fulfillment? How do you live in light of that reality? And I think that's part of the beauty of the gospel and the beauty of the perspective that God allows for us to experience through the work of his son, Jesus Christ, in our lives, is that there's something to say to all of that. Now, a lot of times we go through books of the Bible and we really try to honor the fact that they were the way they were written. You know, you just kind of let them live. And if you live in Ecclesiastes for 7 or 8 weeks, it's really going to just keep doing this for a while. And so we're going to let it do that, but we're also going to remember that there is something that we gather intentionally to celebrate. Ecclesiastes was always pointing somewhere. It did have a purpose to reveal something that we needed to learn and understand, that God's people always needed to have in their purview. And one author in particular, I think, had a helpful view that Ecclesiastes, in a sense, teaches us to live life backwards, meaning it teaches us to take an honest view of the reality of our mortality and of death, and allow that to frame something about how we live right now. It allows us to at least wrestle with, not ignore, at least acknowledge and wrestle with the questions: what's going on? What's it all worth? Why is it all happening? And where is the meaning in the whole thing? And some of you felt that before. If we took time, some of you would acknowledge, yes, I've experienced seasons in the last few years or even in my lifetime where it's felt weary and heavy and burdensome and tiring. I mean, who in here has not experienced a season in your life where you go, that was hard, that was heavy, that was burdensome? Apart from maybe the newborns. The newborns got it made, right? I mean, just waited on hand and foot. They don't even know how good they've got it. But they will let you know when it's not good enough. That's for sure. And I think there's a piece of that where you're like, wait a minute, that I've felt that. How has my life demonstrated my acceptance, acknowledgement, and honesty with that reality? And then there comes this idea of, and this reality of death. And we can, as we said earlier, ignore it or try to cheat it in any way, shape, or form. But at some point in time, we're faced with that reality rather quickly. I mean, have you ever been to a funeral? I'm sure most of you in this room have. And one of the unique things about a funeral is it has a particular kind of way of getting people to be honest about death, but it also has this rare power of creating an opportunity for people to have a renewed perspective on life. And it's a funny thing that to be honest about death might actually help you learn how to live. And I think that's what the author here in Ecclesiastes is getting after. I think there's a sense in which it's like, maybe, just maybe, we all know, right? We're all fully aware. No one's playing games. Death doesn't play favorites. It's coming for everybody. And if we can see it and be honest about it and allow that tension to press in and wrestle down some of life's questions, we might actually just discover that it is one of the means of grace by which we learn to live and live well. Ecclesiastes is like this raw, frustrating look at life in a fallen world. A friend of mine said, Ecclesiastes is like the book in the Bible that feels like it was written on a Monday. I mean, it just... you're like, dude, why did you do this? It kind of gives us a perspective of being brutally honest about life in this universal search that everybody feels at some point in time in life for meaning and purpose and satisfaction. And if you're here in this room and you're like, oh, I love nostalgia. Like, I love things that are nostalgic. Ecclesiastes is like, great, I'm going to mess with you. I'm going to mess with you so bad. And if you're here and you go, well, I'm an idealist, like I have no problem thinking that the ideal can actually be a reality, and I'm a big dreamer and a big thinker, and I'm going to bring people along with me. My vision can't be thwarted, you know? I'm just going to lead everybody to where my dreams are going. Ecclesiastes is like, okay, challenge accepted. Like, I'm going to frustrate you. And if you walked in the doors today and you're like, I was pretty happy today. Like, I don't know what this heaviness is about. I'm a happy person. Like, I smile all the time. My life's pretty light and I'm experiencing a lot of great joy right now. And you walk in filled with kind of a sense of happiness about you. Ecclesiastes says, that's good. Now let's find out if you're really happy and let's find out why. And that's a powerful question. I think that's the benefit or the grace that comes from this book, that it kind of has you in a spot where it's like, listen, acknowledge everything you want to acknowledge. Let's just ask why. Let's just get underneath it a little bit. Maybe you're here and you are struggling and you are facing doubts and sadness and frustrations, and Ecclesiastes as a means of grace says that maybe, just maybe, you can be honest about all of that, and actually the end is not despair or discouragement. In the end, there is a perspective worth considering that can bring hope and peace and everlasting joy. And even though Ecclesiastes is in some way, shape, or form, perhaps at times a confusing book, the Holy Spirit inspired it and I think gave profound truth for us to enjoy. It's wisdom literature in a unique sense, written completely different than other books that are included in that list of wisdom literature, because Ecclesiastes tells us that we cannot always have the answers to life's most pressing questions. We can ask them, we can find things we need to find, but we may not always find neat, tidy, bow-wrapped answers. And that's okay. It doesn't feel okay, because we want Ecclesiastes to make every piece of life fit neatly into some theological puzzle. That's what we want it to do. But I'm not sure that's actually how it was intended to function. One author summarized the words of the preacher, according to Ecclesiastes, in this way. The fear of God, which the teacher or the preacher recommends, is not only the beginning of wisdom, it is also the beginning of joy, of contentment, and of an energized and purposeful life. And then he goes on to say this, the preacher wishes to deliver us from a rosy-colored, self-confident, godless life with its inevitable cynicism and bitterness, and trusting in wisdom and pleasure and wealth and human integrity. He wishes to drive us to see that God is there, that he is good and generous, and that only such an outlook makes life coherent and fulfilling, and only God could actually deliver it. I think that might just be where Ecclesiastes is leading us, but it might take a little bit of time and work to find it there. Because just wait till you hear how the preacher decided to start the whole thing. Are you ready? Ecclesiastes 1, verse 1. Many of the titles in your Bibles will say, all is vanity. Welcome to church. Everything's meaningless. See you later. You know, it's like that's the preacher in the book, but that's an important place to start. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south, goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, they will there flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It is already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance for former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Stop there for this morning and think for a moment about what is being articulated. At the very outset of this book, you and I have sketched for us a very basic and almost bleak reality that is necessary for us in life. And the sketch for us is accepting death, in a sense, becomes the first step of learning to live. We alluded to that already, but there's a sense in which wisdom is found in the beginning of being able to actually rightly understand what is going on and where it's all heading. And so you have the preacher, which is a word that means the one who gathers, and there are many who believe that this is Solomon, because when you read through the book, you go, well, you read through this, it seems like a biography, as it were, of the life that he lived. It doesn't explicitly say that, which is unique, and it's written a little different than he typically wrote, but I don't necessarily think that needs to raise much caution for us, because it's kind of clear who this book alludes to in terms of the life that is lived and talked about. And so I think there's a freedom to go, well, we're not 100% sure, but we are 100% sure who this is pointing to and why. And so there's some freedom in that. But the preacher, as is mentioned here, is writing, as it were, this reflection on life and kind of saying that everything you might want to go in pursuit of to find meaning and fulfillment is vanity. Or many interpretations say meaningless. And truthfully, I'm not sure if either are wonderful words for us. Like vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. The NIV, I think, translates meaningless. Meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. That's kind of how the whole thing starts. That the word there is actually one that is used often to mean breath or breeze. It's just a breath. It's like blowing out air. So if you, everybody for a second, until 2 years ago, I'd have never second-guessed this decision I almost made, which was to have everybody try this. And so here we are. But everybody knows what that's like. I mean, it's just, you know, if you hold it all in for a second and you release it, it's that. It's like, that's the picture here. It's that fast. It's that quick. It disappears that quickly. If you're outside on a cold day and you breathe out, you can see it in the air, but it's not long before it's gone, right? It's over. And so there's a sense in which the word that the preacher is using is that the vanity is like a puff of air. And so I think the rendering there of verse 2 that actually helps us see what the preacher's saying is the merest of breaths, the merest of breaths, everything is a breath. I think that's, in a sense, what the preacher's trying to say to you and I in everything he's about to explain. He says, I just want you to know something about life. It's like breath that disappears. Everything is like breath that disappears, breath that disappears. All of it like the breath that's gone. And it speaks to the fleeting nature of life, this elusive nature of life. It's like a whisper spoken into the wind. It's problematic, it's mysterious, it's confusing, it's hard, because you can't grab it, no matter how hard we try to control it. And that is part of the nature of the way in which sin corrupted all the things in life. Because from the very beginning, we were always, in a sense, what sin did was this effort to grasp the control. And Ecclesiastes is this palpable reminder, you don't control it. And as a matter of fact, it's going to keep doing what it's doing, whether you like it or not. And the faster you recognize that life is like breath, and all the activities of life are like breath breathed out, the faster you might discover something of wisdom, something wise, something helpful about life. And he goes on in verse 3 to pose a question that really becomes kind of an anchor question for the entire book. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So if you get stuck somewhere, there's two things that become kind of helpful keys, I think, in this book. The first is this anchor question, and it's a place that you can kind of go back. So when you're reading through Ecclesiastes, he's going to say some very harsh things. And if you get a little stuck in the book, you can sometimes go back to verse 3 and be mindful of the fact that I think there is this kind of, along the way, every description he's giving is connected to this question, which could be, in a sense, what gain or what advantage do we receive in all the toil under the sun? Or it's a financial term, really. What is the gain of your life? Is it gain or is it loss? When you consider everything, the cost of your life, the cost of your pursuits, the cost of everything you're chasing after, the cost of everything you're grasping after, but it's hard to grab a hold of because it's like breath. Everything you're trying to grab a hold of for meaning and purpose, what's the gain in it all? And the preacher comes to answer this question, that it is vanity. meaningless, transient, smoke, breath, the merest of breaths that disappear faster than you can catch it. And I think that's what starts to raise a little bit of the tension. There's a second key. It's really at the end of the book. We try at times not to jump too far there. I think it's going to do us well to grab it a little sooner than later and allow it to frame some of the book. But this one is this kind of anchoring question that you go, when I start to get lost or if I start to wrestle with the tension, I'm going back here and I'm just being reminded the question the preacher is asking is, what is the gain or the advantage of all the toil under the sun? I think this is where that tension gets created, because a lot of us disagree, as it were, practically with the preacher. We might theoretically or theologically say, man, that's a really good question, and it's leading me to a really good answer. But I think if we assess our lives, there's a real natural tendency, if we're true about it, to realize that our labor and our work and our pursuits and all the things we give our time and energy and money to often might share a different answer to the question than the one we like to articulate. I think Ecclesiastes just says, I'm going to force you to deal with that. You're just going to have to at least acknowledge it, that maybe there's a gap. That maybe, just maybe, what answer comes out of your mouth with this idea of what is the gain of all the toil might look different than what actually plays out in your life. And I'm going to force you to expose that tension and wrestle. And part of how he does that is he jumps right into this visual kind of look at creation and everything that's been created. This is a unique spot because the preacher here does not give, in a sense, any credit in creation to God in this book. So, you know, you go to Genesis 1, you go to the Psalms, you see all these reminders of creation and the way in which creation works and exists. And oftentimes you find these beautiful appeals to God as the author and sustainer of those things. But here you have a different kind of look at the way in which life works. And I think the point is, because he's reiterating something about the nature of the question he's asked in verse 3, and because he's really holding something to be revealed as you press in and live in the tension that is being exposed. And so listen to verses 4 through 11 again, and just kind of think of maybe the cycles that show up, the bookends that are mentioned here. So he says something early and comes back to it, says something, comes back to it a little bit. Verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. And so what you see in verse 4 is he says generations come and go, and then you can get to kind of this bookend. You get to verse 11, and it's like there's going to be no remembrance of this by those who come along after. It's just going to pass in memory. There's a repetitive cycle in verses 5 and 6, right? The sun goes up, the sun comes down. The wind blows to the north, and the wind blows to the south, and it returns. The streams flow to the ocean, but the ocean's never full, and the streams keep flowing. And you get this kind of creation picture, the cosmic rhythm of the world, the cyclical rhythm of life, that the preacher is alluding to, and you have to ask yourself, what's the point? Why is he driving at these images that feel like hamster wheels? It feels like you and I can keep trying as hard as we may try, toiling as hard as we may toil under the sun, and the preacher's just going, hey, listen, that's fine, but just acknowledge something. It's all gonna keep going. And you don't control it, and you don't stop it. It's not yours. So what do you do with that? I think the point is to reiterate from the question in verse 3, these images that he wants us to see. Generations come, generations go. The sea is never full. The eyes are never pleased with seeing. The ears are never filled with hearing. I don't think he's just saying life's hard, deal with it. I don't think so. I think he's saying that there is something that has to be raised internally that says, what is the advantage or the gain from the sum total of life and pursuits and work and toil? And his conclusion to that, even when you get down into verse 8, his conclusion to that is, you are weary. That's the sum total. That's where he's landing at this moment, that the gain or the advantage is wearisome burden of life. And it's really harsh, right? It's harsh to get to the point where you're saying that the sum total of all the things that are happening in the moving order of creation as it has been designed, and however God is sustaining it, which is not mentioned here, but however it's sustained, it just keeps on going. And your life's in the middle of that under the blazing heat of the sun, and you work and you work and you work and you pursue and you pursue and you pursue. And where is it all leading? And the preacher says to you, it's leading to being weary and broken down and heavy-hearted, exhausted, finished, empty, meaningless. In the end, he says, you know where it's all going? In the room this morning, just briefly raise your hand if you can remember the names of the grandparents on both sides, all the sides of your family. Just the grandparents, just one generation above. Yep. Now keep them up if you can remember all of the names of your great-grandparents. And then keep them up one more time if you can remember great-great-grandparents. On every side, you know their names. Just trying to make sure I'm not. Maybe one. Could you go beyond great-great? Most of us. In our own family, our own story in this spinning world. Don't know the line past four generations. And the preacher just says, see, I told you. Now, you're like, how is this book going to encourage us when we already feel all this? How in the world is this book going to help anybody? I think what the preacher's doing is he's answering his own question. There's no gain from the labor or the toil because we're all going to die and be forgotten. But I think really what he wants is the reality of death to kind of sink in, the reality of the brevity of life to sink in, to lodge down into our heart and mind and soul just a little bit, and to think about the ways in which that might have us reconsider where we're going to go after meaning or purpose or value in life. Where the toil efforts are going to be given, where the drive's going to be directed. So if you take all of Ecclesiastes to answer this question, which is what the book actually invites you to do, take the whole book to answer the question, you do start to think, oh boy, fun 8 weeks we got ahead of us, you know. But perhaps we can actually get a little bit of a glimpse of the answer from the preacher's lament over his own life. So on one hand, I think when you think about these verses, you can actually see them as a bit of a lament, like an honest appeal about life, but there's something else coming. There's something more to it. As one of the ways in which we can think about a lament, there's a lot more to say there, but and I think that you get a revelation, as it were, of the ways we're tempted to try to answer the question or avoid the question or appease our conscience in the midst of the toil. The first is to try to escape it. So the idea of escape life or escapism is the idea of trying to run away from the weight of this reality. And the only thing I would say is that billions of dollars are spent in our world to try to help us forget about the brevity of life. Not just in substance, but in streaming services, travel, sports, and everything else we might fill time with. And none of them tend to be inherently evil or bad. They are the evidence of the things that sometimes we grasp after so that we don't feel the weight of the brevity of life and the reality of the question as it's answered. So we escape, right? I mean, who hasn't said, I am living for, and you put a date out there and it's your next vacation. And it's not wrong. You're just acknowledging something that the author is saying, hey, acknowledge it. Acknowledge it so that you might actually start to discover a means by which that vacation can mean something. Or acknowledge it so that you might discover the means by which that trip or that time away or that time with family or that downtime overnight or that time with friends or that alone time might actually do something purposeful. But right now he's just getting you to realize the natural tendency is try to run, baby, and try to run as fast and far as you can to find rest or to escape even having to deal with this. Now, we know ultimately that might lead to more challenging realities, and I think it's a part of the wrestle that people feel in addiction, but not the only one. And so there's this tendency that those are the means by which he says, well, at least you can acknowledge that there's a natural tendency to try to escape and chase the wind. The second is that you can say, well, I'm not going to try to escape, but I'm going to land in the spot where I go, well, life has no meaning. There is no objective value in anything. Everything is pointless, so why bother? And you become cynical and skeptical about life, and you just kind of turn everything off, and you say to everything, it doesn't matter. And it feels like freedom, except you realize in that response that even in your own heart and your own conscience, you go, there's got to be more. And so even in the meaningless view, you stop at some point in time and go, gosh, I think there's meaning somewhere. Or two, there ought to be. The last is a life of pleasure, right? I mean, that's the famous kind of response. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. So maybe, just maybe, you live it up, consume it up, pursue it, enjoy it, experience it, have it, need it, want it, gotta have it, go get it. And Ecclesiastes is going to show us, no matter how good the experience, how great the moment, how fascinating the person, how incredible the accomplishment, it's still going to leave us wanting to chase something, to covet something, to consume something, to change something. We're still going to have to stop at some point in time and say, if that's the full sum, I am pretending. I'm pretending that the next dollar amount will be the final dollar amount I need to live freely. I'm pretending the next raise will be the final raise I need to justify my existence on this earth. I'm pretending that the next grade or the next scholarship or the next athletic achievement or the next fill in the blank thing I'm pursuing is the final thing I want, but I pretend because as soon as it disappears, I'm reminded. And we do it with relationships, and we do it with people, not just things and stuff and activities. We do it with actual people, that there are times where we go, oh, you know what? The real answer is, if I end this relationship and start this new relationship that looks better and sounds better and feels better in the moment, that'll be the completion of it. Then I'll actually finally have some sense of relief, and I will be happy, because ultimately that must be the end result that we're looking for, happy. And the author of Ecclesiastes says, you'll chase it, but it's like wind. It's like the breath that disappears. And the sum total of the whole thing will leave you asking, what happened? Where did it go? What am I doing? Or perhaps the preacher is pointing to another way, that there's a little glimpse of hope embedded even in the lament of these 11 verses about this state of life. That maybe, just maybe, it's there, it's hidden. We've got to dig maybe for it. Life is a gift. It's not gain. See, it's hidden kind of in verse 2. The merest of breaths. Vanity of vanities, it's merest of breaths, says the preacher, merest of breaths, all is the merest of breaths. And for us, there's this kind of anchoring clue as it leads to the main question that's going to be asked, but what if the merest of breaths is actually the gift? What if the life itself is actually the gift, that whatever we think we've gained will vanish, and we along with it? And no matter how hard we try to change all the circumstances, something else comes along and changes it again. What if learning how to truly live in the world is learning to accept that there is absolutely very little gain or no gain at all from chasing the wind, no gain at all under the toil of the labor that happens under the sun, but actually there was no gain to be pursued to begin with? What if maybe, just maybe, in all the things, even in the picture and image we have before us, it's to stop and to realize that in the stuff that just keeps on moving, what God might actually be helping us see through the preacher's words is that itself, your life, the merest of breaths, is a grand gift. It's a gift of grace from a good and gracious God who created the whole thing and sustains the whole thing. And though sin actually corrupts and maligns all of this good creation, it cannot actually keep us from experiencing the mereness of breaths as a sweet, generous, unbelievable gift from the God who loves us and knows us and who made us. And it doesn't relieve the tension of the life of the time in between, and it doesn't relieve actually the momentary kind of ache and longing and hurt and toil and pain and death that we experience, but it actually does provide some new kind of perspective that maybe, just maybe, God is up to something in life. God is up to something in the merest of breaths, that even though it's like that and it's gone, God has put profound, eternal purpose and meaning and wonder in the midst of it. I'm going to ask Carissa and the others to come back up. And as they do, I just want to read this kind of capturing for a moment of the beauty of Ecclesiastes and where I think it takes us. The author says, "The reality is we spend our lives trying to escape the constraints of our created condition. Opening our eyes to this is actually a significant means of discovery. To be human is to be a creature. To be a creature is to be finite and to recognize that we are not God, we are not in control, and we will not live forever. We will surely die. But we avoid this reality by playing pretend. We pretend more money solves more problems, more politics saves more nations, harder work always leads to more fulfillment, leaving old relationships will bring along new ones, exciting ones, and promotions are always blessings instead of potential curses, and freedom to do what we want is real freedom, and social media lives are real, and social media posts change hearts, and whatever the virtual pretend reality we're believing, Ecclesiastes strips all of it away, and it strips away our self-deception, and it says this, You can pretend and you can run. But life in the sinful, toilsome world is an ever-present reality of death is coming for us all. And there's only one way to actually understand that there is no gain from the toil. And that is to believe that even the merest of breaths is a good and generous gift. Sometimes you have a tendency to not want to run ahead too far. I fight that a lot. We're going to sing together and be reminded of our hope in Jesus Christ. Jesus is a livable, tangible, eternal reminder that there is a way different than meaningless, deceptive toil that we often give ourselves to. The life of Jesus Christ acknowledges the harsh, honest reality of death. And yet at the same time, it rests in the transforming reality of knowing the one who can bring freedom, who can remove fear, and who offers eternal life through his own death and his victorious resurrection. So maybe, just maybe, Ecclesiastes was always going to be intended to be a flashing arrow pointing forward, even before we knew where it was ultimately pointing. Let's stand and let's declare our hope in Jesus Christ for even the merest of breaths.
Thank you for joining for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child the repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. We'd love to connect with you, so we invite you to reach out to us at summitupstate.org.